cool.
Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, when cheeseheads attack, the election in Wisconsin gets heated. Can the recall work? Is this a referendum on the elections in November? Has big labor lost its influence? With the president in New York City for fundraisers, is the president too close to Hollywood, and is it a liability? Kofi Annan meets with the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, this week on Syria. Should we be doing more? You know, we should probably ask Henry Kissinger. The Queen's Jubilee ends today. Why does the world love QE2? This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. On Blog Talk Radio from Joey's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Joining me as they do every Tuesday, to my left, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former Vice President of Burlington Northern Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Hi, Al.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Great, great.
I was only the Vice President of Government Relations. I wasn't Vice President of the whole works.
Well, I should have said that. I'm sorry.
Because they'll sue me.
I know they do. They sue everybody. Now they're Burlington Northern Santa Fe. Kidding. To our friends at Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad, we love you.
Yeah.
To my 12 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday when we're all here in town, he is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald Ford, the former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is longtime Washington insider. He's the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, how are you?
I'm just fine and glad to be here with everybody around us.
This is 2 weeks in a row. I don't know if Bob or anybody knows what we're going to do with ourselves now.
Well,
good Lord.
Let's not get too personal.
Don't get, okay. And we've started early. To my right, he is the Vice President of Eurasia Center. He's the Vice President of the Eurasia Center for China Affairs. He's a bar-certified attorney in the great state of New York and the District of Columbia. He is Dr. Ralph Winnie. Ralph, how are you?
I'm doing great. And don't forget, I'm a member of the Supreme Court Bar.
Okay. Yeah, I'll include that, too. Hey, and joining us from Maryland, he is the former chairman of the Democratic Party for the great state of Maryland. He is longtime political insider, Carl Toobin. Carl, how are you?
I'm good.
Good. And missing again after a long celebration. You know what's funny is? He's celebrating his wedding longer than the Queen celebrated her Diamond Jubilee. Alan Moore, still out of town, celebrating his nuptials. Congratulations again to the lovely couple. Lots going on today. Wait a minute. It's Tuesday. That means somebody's voting today. Oh, wait a minute. It's the recall election in Wisconsin. We've been waiting weeks for this. This is huge. This, not really. It's kind of drawn down, guys. The cheeseheads are on the attack. What we have now is a situation where the general electorate of the great state of Wisconsin have called for a recall vote of Governor Scott Walker, Republican, and now they're in a head-to-head race to see who will take over the governor's mansion in Madison in a fight with Democrat Tom Barrett, the former mayor of the great city of Milwaukee. It has been contentious, I think, is a good word we can use. I think everybody understands that word. And there is a lot of back and forth on this, and so many factors in play, but let's start with the big question. The big question is, and I'll go to you, Bob Hines, why is this Wisconsin vote such a big deal? Why has this captured the entire political attention of America?
Well, it's funny that we start on this issue because what originally was the struggle, the question of benefit programs, the collective bargaining power and authority, and the union started with that. They're not talking about that at all anymore. They're talking about a whole variety of other things they don't like the governor's done. And it's interesting to me because of the fact that a lot of the apparently national Republicans are unhappy, pardon me, Democrats are unhappy about the strong push that Labor did in Wisconsin, and they're afraid it's going to be a loss, and it's going to be politically damaging to the Democrats and to big labor.
And we're going to talk about the big labor factor here in another segment, but I want to focus right now on this race. Al, your party's candidate, the former mayor of Milwaukee, when we look at Barrett's record, there's a lot of people that he was not the first choice by either big labor or by a majority of the Democrats at the national level and at the DNC. Did that automatically put them behind the eight ball, do you think, that he wasn't the one they really wanted going forward?
Well, generally speaking, the people that the professionals in the business, and they get a lot of criticism, and sometimes they deserve a lot of criticism, very frankly. But they do know something. There's something that they're all that experience that they have.
That's why they're professionals.
That's the reason they're professional. Yeah. And so turning down how they suggest you run an election and who you run is very dicey.
Well, but let's be clear. I mean, the professionals, there's been no lack of money going into Wisconsin. However, Bob, it seems like the GOP has just flushed money into our friends in the cheese state. It has been a cash cow, for no pun intended, literally going into this race. They're outspending almost 4-1 against the Democrats. Does that shock you?
No, it doesn't shock me. The public unions in almost any state, they have over the years, by a little bit accretion, you know, different elections, different governors' opportunities to get a little bit more. And they have, in good times, it isn't really a problem. But when things are bad in the economy and you're still spending the kind of money that the state governments are required to spend on benefits, retirements, Medicare, salaries, the automatic increases every year, 5-6%, that kind of stuff, you know, it gets tough. And I think this the Republicans saw as a chance to raise this issue and help people understand that it can be a serious problem.
But we go to Carl Tooman. You know, you're a former party chair of the Democratic Party up there in Maryland. Does it surprise you that the DNC and particularly the White House haven't gotten more involved in this?
Well, the DNC has gotten involved. Debbie Wasserman Schultz was there last week, and they poured money in. The Democratic governors have poured money in. So the Democratic Party has been involved in this race.
Well, does it surprise you, Carl, that we're seeing a 4-1 gap between the GOP and the Dems?
No, it doesn't, and I'll tell you why. It's because the Koch brothers and others are really hoping that this is going to put the unions back behind the eight ball, way far behind the eight ball. And this is a battle which they hope will, if Walker wins, will spread to other states throughout the country. So this is a very, very important election, and it doesn't surprise me at all that the super PACs have put in tremendous amounts of money. I heard at one point it was 8-1 super PAC money versus Barrett money.
Yeah, that number is true if you include the super PAC money. I mean, there's been a definitive lack of super PAC money going into the Barrett camp. Is that because maybe, Al, he wasn't the number one pick? I think if they had a much more brighter superstar in the party, that they would have actually picked and put a lot more money in the Democratic super PAC?
I think you have to be a lot closer to it than I am to know that. But I do think this. I think that they started out to try and defend collective bargaining. The governor made the mistake, or perhaps it was his intent, to not just go after the public employee unions, where you can make a good case that they have had the ability to kind of overdo. And in fact, he took on essentially all unions and the whole concept of collective bargaining.
And, right. And by the way, I forgot to announce our big news. We have a toll-free number that our listeners can call in. If you would like to call and join the discussion either on the Wisconsin race or anything political, you can call in toll-free at 877-662-3713. Again, that number is 877-662-3713. Call in. The phone banks are open. Ralph, you had a comment.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that Barrett has not been particularly strong about collective bargaining rights, which have been supported and pushed by the unions. And it's likely that the unions may have overplayed their hand in Wisconsin. And now you have National Democrats, with the exception of Clinton and Wasserman Schultz, sort of staying hands-off in this race. It could be very dispiriting loss for the Democrats and the unions.
Go ahead, Bob.
One of the things that the Democrats have not talked about at all, but is the most, I think, and Al can maybe help me, because I'm not too close.
You're not a Democrat.
I'm not too close to too many union officials. But the thing that at the beginning of this fight, the thing that was the most important to the unions was the fact that the law that the governor got passed, in effect, says that the state is not going to collect the dues, and they have lost, I'm told, about one quarter of their union membership in Wisconsin, because the voluntary payment is no longer mandatorily taken out of your salary, like taxes or medical benefit pills, anything else.
But Al, I mean, as a Democrat, you have to admit the Democrats in Wisconsin and Barrett himself are behind the collective eight ball. When you've got a governor who's going around touting $154 million surplus, he's talking the additional 30,000 new jobs since he took over the mansion in Madison, and a 6.7 unemployment rate, which is hugely below the national average. Those numbers don't lie. I mean, he's got a good argument. How are the Dems and Barrett going to be able to fight that?
Well, I think the way this thing has developed since they started it, it's kind of gone the wrong direction. And now they're stuck with it, and maybe they wish they hadn't started the whole thing.
But
if the governor had not been looking for a fight, there wouldn't have been this fight. This has been handled in other states.
New Jersey, Ohio.
Yeah. And the governor was looking for a fight, and he got it, and apparently he's going to win it, which I think is very sad.
Bob, was this thing mishandled by the Dems, do you think?
Well, it's easy to say it was mishandled because they're not winning. But, I'm not close enough to understand, what decisions were made by national Democrats. I'm not sure how much the unions and the Democrats are working together. I have seen several articles recently where apparently the National Democratic Party has kind of got stepped back a bit because they don't want to be involved in it quite as much. And I think maybe that's a combination of they wanting to put their resources someplace else and the fact that the polls are showing that the governor is ahead by at least eight points.
It's
pretty popular. They like what has happened since he has been in the governor's chair.
So, well, I think the Democrats are going to have to rely on their ground game, but there's so much voter fatigue in Wisconsin. This is, I think, something like the fourth election already, and people are just really dispirited. They don't want to come out.
But I think there might be voter fatigue, but I think people are going to come out in this one, and I think you're going to have a very large vote, and it's going to depend on Milwaukee County and whether the vote is higher in Milwaukee County than it was in 2010. If it is appreciably higher, Barrett has a chance of winning this race.
Well, but, I mean, you're also talking about, Carl, you're looking at counties like Brown County up in Green Bay. Brown County is a traditional lunch pail Republican collective up there. These are conservative union members that tend not to vote Democrat. You've also got the areas around Kenosha and some of the interior areas like Eau Claire, which have been heavy Republican. That's That's Paul Ryan country. You know, are they more motivated maybe than the Democrats in some of the liberal areas like Madison and Milwaukee?
We'll find that out tomorrow morning.
Good point. Good point. Al, when you look at the numbers, according to Politico, our friends at Politico are saying that there's an estimated 2.6 million to 2.8 million voters that are expected to vote today. That number seems to be a little light. That's only roughly about 20% of the registered electorate in Wisconsin. Is that going to be a hindrance for Barrett, do you think?
Well, if that's true, that will be a hindrance for Barrett. Now, Carl is saying that it's not going to be light. He thinks it's going to be strong in the areas where the Democrats are strong. And that's another thing we'll find out in the morning.
This is literally a fight to the finish, and every vote's going to count in this fight.
Sure. It's going to be. I think it's going to be a pretty close vote, personally.
Really?
Yeah.
You think it'll be within?
Well, they're thinking already of both sides evidently have hired lawyers, recount lawyers, so they're expecting it to be a very, very close race.
Wow. Let me ask this question because this is a question that everybody has an opinion on, and since we're like ears, everybody's got them. Bob, I want to ask you: do you think? Well, actually, let me go to Congressman Al. Do you think the Democrats were bullied into this fight by a union?
I don't know what the interaction was. It was certainly a gauntlet thrown down by the governor that the unions could not ignore. It was an attack on collective bargaining, which is the fundamental bedrock principle of organized labor.
But again, that's an argument that's been drawn back, and now they're looking at the economic argument right now in Wisconsin.
Apparently it didn't sell, I don't think that the Democrats had to be badgered into supporting it. Labor is one of their regular...
I think Al's exactly right. This goes right to the very fundamental question of the power of the unions. And, you know, the ability to have those automatic payroll deductions is key to them, number one. Number two, they have a lot of folks up there who are union in Wisconsin, and they had to go in. Now, you can argue that, it's a tough issue. You can argue that the Democrats should have done more of this, that, or the other thing. But it's a core issue for the Democrats, and particularly the union Democrats, and they had to go in and they had to fight as hard as they could.
But you've got some of the biggest, strongest, still to this day, influential unions out there.
Yeah.
You know that Mr. Hoffa and the International Brother of Teamsters were huge in pushing for this vote. You've got President Trumka of AFL-CIO. Trumka's been pushing for this. You've got AFSCME, you've got the other public sector unions, all these people push. I mean, they literally invaded the state house. How, Al and Bob, do you think that this was not pushed by big labor and not the general electorate?
Was it? Of course it was pushed by big labor. They are the institution that guards this chicken coop, and they will do it. And also, you just listed all the big unions that are for this, and you earlier asked whether the Democrats were badgered into this. Look at their supporters out there. I mean, you just take a look at who is supporting this and for who this is important to, and if you're a Democrat, you know, you better be on that side.
Go ahead, Bob. I'll give you the last word.
This is the base of the Democratic Party's key structure, key group of people who are, you know, who are their bread and butter members.
All right. Well,
that's the reason that the Republicans and the Koch brothers and what have you want to win it. It strikes at the heart of the organization.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go to that issue and that topic. Have the unions lost their influence, or are they still as strong as ever? This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio Live from Washington, D.C., from Sally's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town. And I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu, the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah.
From Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. You can join the conversation at 877-662-3713. Again, that number is 877-662-3713. We're going to continue the discussion on what's going on in Wisconsin right now. Largely, we talked in the last segment about the influence of big labor in getting this recall of Scott Walker in place and the race with Walker and Barrett up there in the Great Dairyland. But the question now becomes, with union pushing this recall vote, the question now comes up, has the unions, big labor, lost their allure? Have they lost their influence? Are they as strong as they used to be, let's say, back 60s, 70s, and even into the 90s? Bob, I'm going to start with you. Has big labor lost its allure?
Well, I'm not sure that as a Republican I'm really in a position to talk about.
Oh, no,
I'm
with the Democrats here in a second.
About the
but
strength
go ahead.
Of the unions, but I would say this. I mean, like, the unions are not as strong. Let's say the private, the public unions are, I think, as strong as ever. The private enterprise part of the economy, which has union labor, has much less union labor than they used to.
You're talking like Teamsters, UAW.
Yes, exactly. Now, but the unions that are still very powerful and have a lot of money and have a lot of clout are the public unions, because
SEIU, AFSCME.
Yeah, all of these, because they've got 50 states to take shots at, and when you get a Democratic legislature and a governor, you can get some benefits increased and then get your package of benefits better, and that's what they do, and that's what they should be doing. That's what their job is to. But the fact of the matter is, I think this is a good example that even there, when maybe your benefits are seen as too much in a hard time, it may be that they're going to lose some clout.
Al, do you think that labor's lost its clout?
Of course it has. Over the years, and you go back into the farther than you went, go back into the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. Where you had a lot of Republicans that were afraid to vote against the unions. Most Republicans figure that it's to their benefit to criticize the unions and what have you. So they've lost clout with the general public, and I have felt for a lot, as somebody who really strongly believes in the right of collective bargaining, I have been kind of wringing my hands for decades now that the unions haven't been keeping an eye on their public relations with the public, because I think that some of their tactics, some of the issues that they have taken on, the way they've taken them on, has been a put-off to the general public, and that's where they've lost it. If the general public understood, and if the unions had been explaining the importance of the labor movement to all workers in the society for the last 20 years, I think they'd probably be winning in Wisconsin.
Carl Tooven, do you think that labor has lost its allure at the state level?
Labor has lost a lot of allure over, as we've all agreed, over the last, 10, 15 years. Union membership is down in almost all the unions, they're hurting. Now, when you look at Wisconsin, I think the big fight came over the fact that Wisconsin was the first state to put in collective bargaining. And, you start taking that away the way they did, the way the governor did, just got everybody up in arms. I mean, Democratic state senators left the state to try to stall the whole thing from going on. There were shouts. One meeting, there was a senator that got up and said, you're not doing this right. This is unconstitutional. I mean, all kinds of things which led to the recall. Now, the labor part of it might have lost its allure to the voters, but still, there's a lot of things in Wisconsin that some people don't like, and that's why I think you're going to have a fairly large turnout and possibly what people would call an upset, although the polls, the polls have been tightening up in the last two or three days.
Well, when we look at everything out there, I mean, let's call it what it is. The unions still bring a lot of money, Bob Pines. They still bring a strong ground game when you look at the get out the vote abilities of the unions. I mean, when Barrett walks into a United Auto Workers Hall in Kenosha and it's overflowing at the rafters, those people are going to go out and hold signs. Those people are going to go out and tell their families to go vote. They're going to drive people to the polling stations. Should that give them, I mean, does that prove that maybe they haven't lost their influence, or that should give the Dems maybe a hand up?
Well, look, Al's right. They have lost some popularity, no doubt about it. I mean, that's just reality. But the problems, you can talk about, the union guys in the halls, and they want to get out and work, and they do. But the problem, to some degree, I think, is you can find examples all over the country, and I'm not trying to, say it's a huge, monstrous problem, but the reality is you can find examples of where people who have been in the public service for 25 years and retire, I saw an article recently about a California sheriff. He'd worked for about 22 years. His top salary was $60,000, but his pension was $180,000 a year.
Wow.
Now,
wow.
How do you justify that to an average voter?
Al, I'll go to you.
Well, let me give you a couple of examples of what I think the union did wrong. Instead of being concerned about job protection overall and protecting salaries and so forth, so many unions got into jurisdictional disputes that made absolutely no sense. And when they came to the public that somebody, one union member was hauling the cord over to the wall and another one had to come and plug it in, I just made that up. I don't know whether that's a real, but things
that may be real.
things like that, I think, really began to curdle the general public's feeling about unions. And they shouldn't have done that. There are other ways to protect their members without getting into that kind of stuff.
Now, for full disclosure, let me be clear. I am a supporter of some of the unions. I like what, you know, let's call it what it is. The UAW helped rebuild what is Ford, GM, and Chrysler. They went to the table. They made concessions. It was painful for them as much as it was painful for GM and Toyota. I like what, you know, the FOP or the PBA, the Fraternal Order of Police and the Police Benevolence Association, they protect those who protect us. You look at Teamsters. Teamsters and the Teamsters, and I am a fan of the Teamsters. Some of my dearest friends are in the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. They understand that without the business thriving, their people don't work. So let me just be clear. I am somewhat pro-union. But, Bob, you have a comment on that.
I will tell you that I have at home my Teamster card.
You are a member of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters?
I was at one time. Oh. I drove one of my jobs when I was very young and I was making some money to get through school. I drove a dry cleaner's truck. You know, pick up clothes and then take them to the shop and get clean, and I would, you know, take them back out. I was a Teamster.
Well, let me ask you a question.
And I enjoyed it immensely, and I enjoyed the relationships and the fun, and I had a good time being a Teamster.
Well, let me ask you this question. Since, you know, you had skin in the game back in the day, is the Teamsters union that you knew back then different from the Teamsters union today? Do they have the same... Do they have the same influence over their members that they may have?
No, I don't. I don't think they do. I think Al's right. I think that I'm talking about the 50s, and there was an awful lot more. There were an awful lot more of private business union members than there are today. And I'm not talking just about the big companies like the auto workers or the steel workers. I'm talking about just smaller operations.
Al,
I think the unions failed to modernize. They failed to adjust their message to the workers and to the public to fit the attitudes that currently exist. The issues are the same, and they shouldn't change those, but they need to explain them differently. They're sitting there like Samuel Gompers giving that kind of a defense for organized labor when there are much better ones that I think that they could have used.
Carl Tuven, let me go to you. I mean, you know, being the former chairperson of a state party, they obviously had as much state influence as they did national influence. Were they a help to you as the chairman of the party back then, and are they giving the same type of support back then to the state parties today?
The unions in 1959-61 were very supportive of state party activities. And, of course, you had the Kennedy-Nixon battle, and they were very hot on that battle. They didn't want to see Richard Nixon in the White House. And, they were very, very active. They were ground troops. They contributed money. The whole phone banks, the whole ball of wax.
But Bob, I mean, nowadays in today's social media world, in the days of robocalls, you don't need that kind of ground troop action that you did maybe back then. Is that something that may be a hindrance to having the unions be the big political players? I mean, because let's be real. I mean, well, go ahead and answer because I got a comment after that. Go ahead, Bob.
I would disagree with anybody who says you don't need troops on the ground. I still think that's very, very important in any election. And, of course, now there aren't as many union members, who to be troops on the ground, except public union members. I mean, you know, public employees. But there are fewer. There's fewer people available to be troops on the ground.
But let's be real. I mean, Al Swift, I mean, we are looking at the people that are in power today in the unions, the big political players, and namely, I'll mention the two big names. That's Hoffa and Trumka. They're still very influential with the White House. I mean, you know, the Teamsters will tell you that a large part of why Obama got elected was because they had the backing of the Teamsters. Trumka will tell you that the reason why the Democratic Party will probably win in this upcoming election is because of their support. They still have the ear of a lot of people on the Hill and at the White House.
Absolutely. I hope the comments we've been making, when you said, have they lost clout from some time ago, and we're all saying yes, does not be interpreted as saying they are now weak and can be ignored, because that's not true.
No.
But let me just mention a little story about their troops on the court. We had a whole bunch of union guys come into my district and work the restaurants and what have you. And one of my people came back and said, there's this guy down there. He's rough. He's cute. He's a little dirty. He's swearing a lot. And he's down there just passing out stuff. Fortunately, he doesn't know your name. So, that's just an aside.
But let's be real. I mean, let's talk about it. I mean, when we talk about the influence back in the day of the UAW, the AFL-CIO, the Teamsters,
the machinists,
the machinists, the laborers. When you look at those, I mean, there were times when many thought that big union was a wholly owned subsidiary of organized crime, which today we know is not the case.
This begs the question, why hasn't Obama come into Wisconsin to campaign for Barrett? I mean, if this was 20, 30 years ago, you'd have the Democratic sitting president come in and support the Democratic challenger.
Well, that's a good question.
I think that's a maybe. I'm not sure that another president would have gone in and done, would have refused to go in. Obama, he is still ahead in the polls in Wisconsin, and they didn't think that he should go in. And he stayed out until last night when he tweeted his endorsement of Barrett for whatever. Again, you've had the chairman of the Democratic Party, you've had Bill Clinton, and you've had other people who have gone in to campaign for Barrett and to campaign for the recall.
Right. But
the other thing I wanted to point out is you can be sure that over the weeks and today that unions have canvassed their people, knocked on doors, asking them to come out and vote. And I'm also sure that they have canvassed the people who were thrown out of work in the unions, who lost their jobs because of cutbacks and everything else. And, we'll see again tomorrow what effect that all has had.
Let's look at one factor that Carl brought up is, we talk about the economy versus unions. I mean, last Friday, the jobs numbers came out, and they were abysmal. It is something that the White House had talked about for weeks. We're going to hit 150,000 new jobs. We're dropping the unemployment rate. The unemployment rate hovered. In fact, it rose up to a solid 8.2 nationally, and the new jobs numbers were basically dismal at 65,000 versus the 150 that they were talking about. Is the lack of job creation in the economy today enough to spurn unions to actually increase their membership, gain more power, gain more influence politically, Bob?
Well, I'm sure that they would prefer to be able to, get more union members. But the reality is, look, you just a moment ago reeled off from the past a lot of unions that had hundreds of thousands of members in the private sector. Most of those, unions are, way, way down in membership. That's the reality is that with the union numbers, I don't know exactly what they are, but I do know that the public employees are probably, 75% of the union membership.
I don't know what that is.
And I think it was probably 50-50, let's say 25 years ago.
But Congressman Al, the economy, a bad economy tends to make people more alert or more aware of where the unions come into play. You would think that abysmal job numbers, even under a Democratic president, would help unions increase their influence, increase their numbers, and increase their ability to drive, you know, the economic discussion at least.
That's the logic.
Does that logic hold true?
It is proved to be not true in the past in a couple of instances. Which election was it in which it was clearly demonstrable that people were going out and voting against their own economic best interests? I think it was the Reagan election. They were buying into his overall philosophy rather than concentrating on what's in it for me. And so I think the whole country has moved in that direction a bit.
Bob?
I agree with Al.
Very good. Very good. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to finish up the topic of what's going on in Wisconsin, because I do want to mention something that was mentioned before, is why hasn't the White House gotten more involved? This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We will be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, for those who listen to Backroom Politics and know about Shelley's Backroom, they think of it as some sort of cigar bar where politicians go to smoke their cigars and drink their martinis. Actually, what you don't know about Shelley's Backroom has one of the greatest menus in the city. I kid you not. You've got the campfire wings, famous campfire wings, 1 pound of roasted, not fried, seasoned marinated jumbo chicken rings served with their own special honey mustard sauce. Folks, if you like chicken wings, you've never had the campfire wings. Best wings in the city, bar none, I guarantee. If you don't like it, Al, you can call us up and tell us that you don't like it. You have daily specials. Come down on a day when they have the Justin Chicken Sandwich, the sandwich named after me, breaded chicken breast, provolone cheese, thick-cut bacon on a Kaiser roll served with a honey mustard sauce. Folks, it doesn't get more artery-clogging than that, but it is worth it. Come down to Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the premier sponsor of Backroom Politics.
And we're back live here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We are continuing the discussion about what's going on in Wisconsin today and the recall vote between Scott Walker and former Milwaukee Mayor Barrett. We're going to talk about the White House influence in all this. The White House is still licking its wounds from a really bad week last week, which we'll talk about right now. Jobs numbers were horrible. Bad, bad campaign decisions from the Chicago crew led by David Axelrod and David Plouffe. And on top of that, they've got this recall election. Congressman Al, I got to ask you, is the bad week that the Obama administration had, did that maybe play into why we haven't seen a lot of them in Wisconsin?
Well, I don't know because I'm not there. But it would be logical that they would be a little more timid about what they do coming out of a bad week like that. That's a guess.
Bob, I mean, how bad of a week was it last week for the White House? I mean, you're looking at, I mean, key decisions. You've got Cory Booker, the Cory Booker factor still laid over from 2 weeks ago. You've got the jobs numbers and then some more gaffes in coming out of the White House and coming out of the campaign. One big gaffe that a lot of people criticized was the way Obama handled the portrait unveiling for George W. and Laura Bush. Is this just amateur politics hour?
I would say everything you named happened, okay?
Right.
Except I don't remember what happened at the White House.
The White House gaffe was he basically took a shot at George Bush during the unveiling. You know, he basically called out the failed economic policies. I'm paraphrasing. Called out the failed economic policies that came up that he inherited. It was just, in my opinion, a classless move.
All right, well, let me suggest that all of that stuff together a month from now will basically be forgotten.
Well, you think the jobs numbers will be forgotten?
No.
Jobs numbers are different. I mean, that's not a gaffe. That's a reality in the market.
Well, I think it was a gaffe. I mean, the administration touting 150,000 new created jobs, and the number comes back at 60,000.
It came back. The first thing, if there was a gaffe there, it wasn't what the number was. It was what they said it was going to be.
Right.
You don't want to volunteer. You don't want to volunteer a number when you don't know what's going to happen. But the fact of the matter is. But all that stuff, these are all minor things. The real question for me is going to be, and I think for a lot of voters, it's going to be the economy.
Yep.
And the problem is not those six or eight gaffes. It's the fact that instead of having 150 or 200,000 jobs, you have 65,000 jobs. Instead of having a drop to 8 even from 8.1, you go up to 8.2. I mean, those are real realities for the economy, and it just reminds people that things are damn bad.
Ralph.
Obama keeps saying that the Republicans are blocking his Jobs Act, which would create more jobs and put people back to work. And it'll be interesting to see if that will resonate with the American people moving forward.
Al, you agree with that?
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I think he's got a case to make. What is so frustrating to me is that he's had a lot of cases that he could have made all along that he hasn't made. So whether he will make that case or not, I don't know.
Bob, I mean, right now we've seen a really lackluster performance in the campaigning side of the Obama administration. And, you know, we're talking about some real political heavy hitters. I mean, David Axelrod, David Plouffe are no amateurs when it comes to presidential campaigning runs. I mean, they got Obama elected. Why are we seeing such almost poor maneuvering by the White House, and again, in a continuation of what we've seen over the past 4 years, we're seeing a bad message or a lack of messaging coming out of 1600 Pennsylvania.
Well, I don't know why it's happening, but I'm just damn glad it is.
And I think we'll find out the answer to that question when people start writing books about the campaign. I don't think we know now.
Carl Tubin, I mean, that's got to be disappointing for you as a former state chairperson watching the lack of messaging coming out of the Democratic White House.
Listen, last week was a very, very bad week. I'm not sure that the White House thing was as bad as you thought it was. George Bush also made some remarks that, you know, you could say were off, you know, when he said, when you walk down the hall, now you're going to have to look at me, etc. I mean, all that is, you know, I thought that all that was perfectly acceptable. When people run a campaign, it's been my experience over the last umpteen years, since 1956. You need to talk about the future, and you need to lay out your plan for the future. Now, I think part of the problem is, and I haven't talked to anybody in the campaign or around the campaign, I think part of the problem is you don't want to get too far ahead of yourself. If you start talking today about the future, it gets lost. And then when you start in September at the convention talking about the future and what your plan is and what your program's going to be and all that, you know, everybody says, well, we've heard that before. We've heard that in June, July, August. And I think that's part of what it is.
We lost Carl there for a second. Al, let me go to you for a second and kind of follow up on that. The messaging just has not been consistent out of the White House. If this were you, or if you were still seated as a member of Congress, or if you still had, well, I still believe you have stroke in the Democratic Party, not as much as you used to, kind of like a labor union, would you now be calling for there to be some really strong messaging? I mean, there's got to be something out there good that they can push.
About halfway through the fight on health care, I began to wonder when the messaging was going to start. And I have this general feeling that it never did. I think there was a lot better story to be told about in defense of the health care bill than the White House did. And so they really haven't been good at messaging anybody. Here's one of the most articulate presidents around, I mean, that we've had. Well,
right.
There's Bill Clinton, there was JFK, there was Ronald Reagan. So maybe that's not good. But he's a very articulate guy. But it's not getting into the campaign mix somehow or other.
Is that the fault of the president, or is that the fault of somebody like David Axelrod, Bob?
Well, I think I'll wait till I read one of the books and they'll tell me.
You can't tell yet.
You know, I don't know who, but obviously the team is not efficiently operating.
Well, I mean, but we talk about, like we were talking about it earlier, you and I, Robert, were talking with the owner of Shelley's, Bob Maserati. Bob had mentioned that there's a new book out, and they talk about how Oprah's back down. We're seeing even candidates now. The Democrat running for Gabby Gifford's old seat out in Tucson are starting to pull back from the Obama administration, not unlike what we saw with certain Republicans back in 2004. Is that a sign of maybe there's a chink in the Obama armor right now, Bob?
You can take a guess, Bob. If I called David Plopp and asked him, he wouldn't tell me anything.
He might tell Al.
Yeah, he might tell Al. He won't tell me.
It's like Bush in 2006 when the Republican candidate.
In 2004.
Well, in the midterm in 2006 when Republicans didn't want to campaign with Bush because he was so toxic.
I mean, there's a similarity to that.
Yeah.
But is that a sign of maybe there is a chink in the armor? Al, I'll go to you.
Well, I don't know whether I call it a chink in the armor. I think that there is a need to improve the messaging. And I think there is a need to explain in very simple terms that Joe Blow, Joe Sixpack, can understand what's in it for him in the health care bill, if they were still talking about that, and exactly how the jobs book is going to work for him, rather than these broad economic generalities.
Bob.
And it isn't too late by a long shot to tighten things up.
No, but...
I mean, it really isn't. I mean, it's still quite early.
No, but we've also seen in past campaigns, especially when you're getting into a midterm president, that it's starting to hit on all eights right about now. They're not making the mistakes that...
Yeah.
I mean, this is a January mistake that they're making now in June.
I would agree with that.
But when you... Now, when we look at everything going on, you know, even Democrats on some of the talking head shows on Sunday, you know, one of them was saying, you know, look, Obama should say it's my way is the highway. We have to improve infrastructure. You know, pass my jobs bill. You want to talk about creating jobs? Let's pass the jobs bill. But even Democrats on the Hill are going, we've done this before, and I'm taking heat for it right now.
And Obama vetoed the Keystone Pipeline, which would
have... Yeah, another factor in this. Al, I mean, is there some way that they can recover if in fact, the economy is the big issue for 2012?
Well, hurting Democrats is a lot like hurting geese.
they bite.
Are you saying that they snap at you and they poop everywhere?
Well, they do that. I find that there's a considerable lack of courage among Democrats on the Hill. They're a little worried, and so they behave in ways that give them more to worry about. You know, if they are out there defending the president, then everything is stronger, including for them. But too many of them are saying, well, I'm going to cut myself loose from this and run on my own. And, well, good luck.
Yeah.
I've seen that backfire.
We are seeing something, and we mentioned it at the opening of the program. The Obama administration in deep campaign mode right now. There's a lot of Hollywood infused in this campaign right now. And there are many inside the Democratic Party that are a little bit worried about that, saying that could be a liability. Al, do you think that's a liability?
No. And I think the people that are wringing their hands about it are weak nellies. I just so you don't have, you know, it's coming up now, so you don't have so many stars around in the future. It will be gone by fall. If they don't pay any attention and they keep surrounding him with Barbara Streisand, then it's going to be a problem. But it's not too early.
But the people they have, the two people that have been out front, Sarah Jessica Parker and I forgot the other guy's name, they are people who most people in the country admire and like, and I think that adds to the campaign and adds to the fact that people are going to look at this in a much more important way.
And we have to remember that that Obama has yet to come up with anything like the Trump.
Wow. I thought we made a pact on that. I thought we said we would never mention that man's name on this show again.
But he popped up again.
Well,
shut up, I'd shut up.
Oh, good Lord.
I
want to go back to Carl.
He's making himself a factor in the campaign.
I want to go back to Carl Tubin. Carl, I mean, when you look at... I can't believe you did that, Al. Yeah, walk away now, Al. Walk away. You know what? I'm going to take.
You're going to come.
No. I'm going to. I'm going to go ahead and call Happy Hour. I've lost control of the show now. I'm going to go ahead and just call Happy Hour. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, the heart of our nation's capital. By the way, folks, it's coming up on Happy Hour. It's 5 o'clock, and we're going to order our drinks. In fact, our guys are ordering drinks right now live on the air. Good job. The American Distillers Association apparently is sponsoring us now. We'll be back in 3 minutes.
You have lost control. Who are you?
Exactly.
Where did you come from?
We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Back Room is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the size of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Back Room, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties.
Cicada number two.
And we're back here in Shelley's back room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. I'm taking moderator privilege, and I'm going to change the subject because apparently we lost control in that last segment. So I'm going to do that.
He has us all tied to our chairs.
Yeah, damn right I do. You go walking away in the middle of a segment. Jeez. We want to talk about a serious issue actually coming up here, and that's the situation in Syria. The situation in Syria, it, just when you thought it couldn't get any worse in Syria, it does. After Friday, 2 weeks ago, after the massacre of literally tens of thousands of Syrians at the hands of the Assad government, it continued, the bloodshed inside homes and inside other towns outside of outside the sphere of influence of the Assad government is just truly mind-blowing. Special envoy for the UN, Kofi, former Secretary General Kofi Annan, has been inside Syria trying to strike a deal for Assad to step aside or at least to stop the bloodshed. It has not worked. Now, as a result, Kofi Annan is returning to the United States to have a meeting this week with Hillary Clinton. First, let's talk about that meeting. Number one, and Ralph, I'll go to you. Okay. Does Kofi Annan have any credibility right now coming over to Foggy Bottom?
I think what's interesting is that you have sort of a split in the Obama administration. You have one camp that really wants to engage and help work with Russia to bring an end to the situation in Syria. But you have the other camp that doesn't trust the Russians and wants Obama really to engage in what we call hard-headed diplomacy and go straight to the country that matters to cut the deal, which is what Henry Kissinger did in the 70s when he made the secret trip to China to open relations. And that's what he did again in 73 during the Arab-Israeli war with a round of Middle East diplomacy that ended up moving Egypt away from the Soviet orbit into the American sphere.
Well, we're going to talk about Henry Kissinger's thoughts in a few minutes. However, I want to talk about, let's talk about the meetings this week with Kofi Annan.
Okay.
Bob, Kofi Annan obviously coming in as a wounded duck right now. Do you think he's got any credibility when he meets in Foggy Bottom with the Secretary?
I think a former, would you just, I think as a former head of the UN, sure he has credibility coming over here. I think the problem is that there's no indication whatsoever at this stage that the Assad administration is going to give an inch. They don't feel pressed enough. They just don't. And I think the reality is, until they get to the point, the way Gaddafi did, that I'm getting overwhelmed. I've got to run or hide or make a deal, and he decided to run and try to hide, and didn't work. But the fact of the matter is, I suspect that until he is pushed harder, it doesn't make any difference who you send.
I think you could send Muhammad, Jesus Christ, and Buddha over there to talk to him, and it would have no effect on this insane, evil.
Not unless
blank. Yeah.
Until the people who go in there with a thunderbolt.
That was the point that I was making, because you're going to have to bring China and Russia on board. And one of the issues that was raised is making Russia feel that their standing in the international community would improve if they were to bring an end to the Assad regime.
Yeah, but Foggy Bottom is going to have a hard time trying to negotiate anything with the Syrians on the basis of this makes Russia feel warm and fuzzy. There's no question about it that Secretary Clinton's got a very difficult road ahead of her. As does Secretary Panetta over at DOD, as far as coming up with some sort of idea of how this is going to play out. But the reality, Congressman Al, Kofi Annan coming here to the United States, is this a maybe last-ditch plea for him to say, look, you got to help me out of this one?
I just don't know the inside of all of those workings. It might be. But it seems to me that Kofi Annan is an experienced guy. He doesn't have power as when he was the
Secretary General.
He clearly doesn't have that. But he's got a lot of knowledge. He knows a lot of the players, and he probably has some ideas. So I think drawing the picture of him coming on bended knee to the Secretary of State, he's coming with something, and we'll see what she thinks of it. You know, but he's an experienced guy.
Ralph,
well, if there's a way for Kofi Annan to work with the U.S. and convince the Russians that, even if you got rid of Assad, that the Russians could still maintain their economic relationship with Syria, continue to sell arms, and keep their ports, Mediterranean port, I think it's Tartus, yet at the same time getting the respect and admiration of the world for taking the lead and bringing an end to this dictator, I mean, then you would have Russia in a very strong position of power. Right now, the Russians are the bane of the rest of the world. They're perceived as being obstructionists. And I think Putin is smart. He wants Russia to have some sort of credibility and respect within the world community, and they're not getting it by their obstructionist position in Syria.
But you know, the Syrian question is obviously a very difficult one. And Bob, we were talking earlier about a piece in the Washington Post over the weekend, written by probably the greatest Secretary of State, at least in my lifetime, Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger is somebody that, you know, somebody's got, we've got to listen to him. When we see Henry Kissinger saying, look, we can't rush too far into this, does that have credibility, do you think, with Secretary Clinton and the Obama White House?
Well, number one, I don't know. But number two, I would suggest that even if they don't decide to do what Kissinger suggests, I would advise them to at least read it and look at it, because Henry Kissinger has probably been as good a judgment of how to work in foreign policy as we have had in our country in the last 50 years. He's been a very good Secretary of State and a very good advisor to presidents, and he knows how to get things done. And he's a very smart guy, and I would certainly listen to him. But you know, I don't know if they're going to do it or not.
I think if Richard Nixon were still alive, you'd want to listen to him, too.
Yeah.
You know, anybody who's got experience in this, you need their input.
And Kissinger has enormous respect among the world community. He'd be the one that could take the lead and encourage the Russians to come to the table and be the power broker to the campaign.
But one of the things that Secretary Kissinger did, and rightfully or wrongfully so, is arguable. But, I mean, the headline in the opinion piece was Syrian intervention risk upsetting global order. He basically says that, you know, if we directly intervene in Syria, we're going to face a possible problem of taking off the rest of the Muslim Brotherhood nations after the Arab Spring, and that's going to create a lit fuse on a powder keg that's already unstable. Why is that message maybe not resonating a lot with, or maybe we don't know, but it doesn't seem that's resonating a lot with the major world powers right now. Al, you're cringing right now.
Well, no, I'm not cringing. I was trying to think through whether that's true or not. I don't see a lot of people, a lot of countries that are all for charging in. They're trying desperately to work out diplomatic ways to do this. And I think that what Kissinger has said, it makes sense even to me. You don't know enough about foreign policy to stick in your ear. It just seems to me that we are spread too thin. We can't follow through. Our allies would not follow. Our allies don't want to do it. So I don't know who he's talking to in terms of don't rush in.
Well, you're gonna have to try and support the opposition in Syria as a start, but at the same time, you're going to have some form of aggressive diplomacy through a Kissinger type of figure that can really bring the Russians and the Chinese.
Well, was
to the
he
camp.
Talking about when he said don't rush in? Was he talking against aggressive diplomacy, or was he talking about taking military action?
One of the things that Henry Kissinger mentions in his piece, in fact, it's the basis for his piece, ironically, is the Treaty of Westphalia. The Treaty of Westphalia, which was signed back in, according to our friends at the Washington Post, 1640. Wow, very good. Bob, were you there? You call that like you knew it, like
Bob
it was yesterday.
Still there.
Yeah. I'm a good Republican.
But, I mean, the Treaty of Westphalia, which ended the 30 Years' War,
yeah.
According to Secretary Kissinger, was the basis of how the global environment arose to what it is in today's modern world. Right or wrong, he claims that the Treaty of Westphalia was to prevent the repetition, as he quotes, to prevent a repetition of carnage, unquote.
Yeah.
So when we look at somebody is beeping, my good Lord.
They're trying to dial into our show.
I guess so. So what we're looking at is, you know, Secretary Kissinger talking about humanitarian efforts. Do we, in fact, have the stroke to go in on a humanitarian level to try and fix this, Congressman Al?
Not alone. I think that whole Mideast thing is something we do not want to do anymore all by ourselves. Or with a put-together coalition that doesn't mean anything. So, no.
Bob?
I wouldn't go in at this stage. I wouldn't go in at all. I would not put any troops on the ground, period.
But if we're talking about a humanitarian effort, is this something maybe the UN should be involved in?
It
has to be the UN with the support of the Arab League,
right,
to name two organizations that could be the overall cover, the umbrella groups.
And I think it would be appropriate for the United States to take leadership. Now, the more low level they can do, you know, the more kind of under the edges they can operate. But I think it takes U.S. leadership to get anything moving there.
But countries are still very reluctant to go in. I mean, even with a coalition.
You look at Bob. You mentioned the the Arab League. We've seen the Arab League, you know, after they said, you know, Assad, you gotta go, they took a very standoffish approach in how the handling of Syria has commenced. We've not heard a lot out of the Arab League.
No,
is that by choice?
Well, I don't know, but I would assume they're doing what they think is, at least at the moment, is the right thing to do. But certainly, we could encourage them to make a stronger statement.
Ralph,
here's what's interesting. China has to worry about getting on the wrong side of the government of Saudi Arabia, who the Chinese are buying a lot of their oil and have a lot of investment projects in that country. And the Saudis obviously want the Assad regime to go, and they're very concerned with China and Russia's position on the Assad regime.
But these are two people who voted or vetoed the original censure of Syria
Security Council.
Right.
Saudi Arabia could be the real trump card here. If the Saudis really get after the Chinese and the Russians, and maybe we'll have them sort of revisit their policy.
Alan, Bob, you guys have been around and you've seen the influence of states like Jordan with King Hussein and his son, now King Abdullah. Why are we not seeing more out of King Abdullah? It would strike me as that if anybody was going to take a strong position, it would be somebody like Jordan.
Well, Justin, the last time I talked to the king,
we've all been around. We've seen how Jordan has been the great voice of reason, almost.
In many instances,
agreed. This one seems to have King Abdullah almost at a loss. What's different now than what may have happened in previous years? Is it just a matter of personalities that maybe King Abdullah isn't as aggressive as his father was?
Well, let's go back to what you mentioned earlier. You know, once the Arab League said something, they haven't done anything else. And I think that may be because Saudi Arabia hasn't decided exactly what they want to do. I suspect that Abdullah is waiting to see how far Saudi Arabia is willing to go because they're the major player
right.
here, and they're the ones who really have to have the most interest in one sense, because if Syria, if the Alawites administration in Syria, that is going to damage Iran substantially, and if there's anything that Saudi Arabia wants, it's Iran to have more problems.
Carl Toobin.
Yes.
Yeah.
Finally, I get bumped off the call during some of the breaks, but let me just say this: Hillary Clinton has been a very good Secretary of State. History will show how good she has been. Number one. Number two, Kofi Annan coming to her to share with her what he has heard from the dictator in Syria is a very important move. You've talked about the Arab League. The Arab League has made many statements that they are not happy with the situation in Syria. You talk about King Abdullah. He's got his own problems in his country, and I'm sure that he's thinking, if I get involved in this, and some of my people are liable to start looking at me and saying, well, if they can overthrow Syria, if they overthrow Egypt, we can overthrow the king. And I think that's a very, very important point.
That's a very, very important point, Carl.
I also think that you know, I misread this whole thing, and which I said this thing would be, we would be into this with other countries in a few days, but I think things have gotten so bad that. You know, everyone is going to go to Russia and China, and they're going to say, you know, you guys are holding this whole thing up. And then if they say no, then there's liable to be a coalition that will do what they did in Libya, and try to end this thing and support the rebels.
All right, but if we look at all things being equal, Bob Hines. We look at what happened in Libya. We saw the success of when a NATO ally does take the lead and does what it can to support, if you will, the overthrow of a dictatorship like we saw with Muammar Gaddafi. Similar buildup here, but not the urge for somebody to stand up saying, I got this. Why is that, Bob?
I haven't the faintest idea, quite frankly.
Wow, we just don't have any ideas about this. Is Syria that convoluted?
No, what I think has to happen is I think Saudi Arabia has to send some kind of a signal.
Yeah.
Because if Saudi Arabia sends some kind of a signal, then the major Sunni power in the Middle East has made a statement that is going to help everybody else, the UN, other countries and NATO and everybody else to get more involved. But I think you've got to see Saudi Arabia say something stronger than we're part of the Arab League and we say we ought to get rid of the guy.
Ralph,
and I agree with Bob, because I think if Saudi Arabia sends the message, then it's no longer in the Chinese and Russian minds, people's minds, as the Western imperialists trying to force a particular position down our throats. It's Saudi Arabia saying, look, China, look, Russia, we need you to come on board and get rid of the Assad regime. But the way to do it, and I think this is what Kissinger is alluding to, is instead of shaming them into dropping support for Assad, offer Russia and maybe China something for it. Encourage them to take the lead and ultimately the credit in an effort to bring down the Assad regime.
Yeah, but that's never been the American way. Where are you coming up with that one?
Well, that's what I've been reading. I mean, we're looking at what Kissinger has tried to do in his foreign policy areas. And this could be something revolutionary. It could be something new. I mean, the Obama administration has tried new things in its foreign policy. So you just never know. if that's an approach that the Obama administration would want to push to end the bloodshed, the violence, and the genocide in Syria.
Well, when we look at this, is Saudi Arabia maybe looking at the way, maybe Carl Tooman said it, are the Saudis concerned for their own power regime? Is that a possibility, Bob?
Well, Saudi Arabia is the most significant Sunni Arab country. You know, the holy cities are Mecca and Medina are there, so they've got that push. They've got enough oil to drown the world, so that's another point in their favor. And they are the big dog. And I think, you know, they need to, in effect, send a signal. I don't know how public it has to be. I don't know how strong it has to be in a visible sense. But they have got to do something to, in effect, help galvanize a broader coalition of people, of countries who are willing to work, get together. And I think that means we've got to, that means the UN, it means NATO, it means the Arab League all have to come together like they did in Libya.
Al, do you agree that Saudi Arabia is a
Yeah.
You do. Carl Tooman.
There's one country, though, that can help do this, and that is us. With our diplomacy behind the scenes, we're probably one of the only countries that can talk to Saudi Arabia and try to get them to move on this. I don't know who else at this point can do that.
Ralph,
I think the Chinese would definitely come on board if Saudi Arabia sent a strong enough signal. The economic relationship is so strong that the Chinese do not want to risk alienating them.
And I don't think the Russians, if the Chinese came on board, I don't think the Russians would stand alone.
Right, and it's no longer a Western imperialism argument among the anti-American groups in China and Russia.
Well, I mean, do we now have to call for, or should America, as a big financier of the U.N., does, in fact, the U.S. call for U.N. intervention? Do we see the presence of blue helmets coming forward?
I'd rather somebody besides the United States would make that plea at the U.N. if that's what we're going to do, if that's what we want.
Yeah, Al?
We might be able to engineer that, but yeah. I think somebody else should be the higher profile.
Lead
from behind.
I'd love the Saudis
lead
to do
from behind.
Right. The other question that comes up here is oddly quiet is Bibi Netanyahu and the Israelis. Obviously, the Israelis have somewhat of a interest in this. Are the Israelis being held back, do you think, by maybe the U.S. saying, hold it, Bob?
I don't think they have to be held back. I think this situation is so fraught with all kinds of dangers to everybody, that the best thing they can do is doing just what they're doing, shutting up.
Al, you agree with that?
I think if Netanyahu shut up forever, it would be a big help.
Carl Tooman, I mean, you're familiar with AIPAC and the Israeli question. It does not surprise you that we've seen little out of Tel Aviv?
No. No. You know, I think Netanyahu at this point is a real question mark as to what he wants in the American election. If, in fact, he's not happy with President Obama, even though President Obama has stayed behind them, maybe he wants President Obama out of there. Maybe he feels that Romney should be the President of the United States. So therefore, they stand on the sidelines, do nothing, and let the chips fall where they may.
That's an interesting take. Interesting take. Well, when we come back, we're going to take a little bit of a lighter note. Obviously, it's something that we're going to keep an eye on. But when we come back, we're going to talk some royalty news. We're going to talk about Queen Elizabeth II celebrating her Diamond Jubilee. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us. We'll be back in 4 minutes.
I think I need.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches. They've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays. Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. A couple of pieces of breaking news coming out of the world news bureaus. One is that the Syrian Assad government has expelled 11 of the nation's diplomats that expelled their diplomats. That's going to be something to keep an eye on. I think that's a very defiant move by the Assad government. And the second piece of news coming out of the Middle East is apparently a U.S. drone strike has killed, according to the Washington Post, Al-Qaeda's number two leader, Abu Yah al-Libi. That is a big blow to Al-Qaeda. That's something that's going to take them off their heels, don't you think, Bob?
Oh yeah, this guy was one of the top two or three people left in their universe, and they've got it. And he was one of the big planners for the different kind of attacks, and they killed him, and that's great.
I mean, when we talk about U.S. drone strikes, we were talking during the break that, you know, obviously the U.S. drone strikes, very tactical, very surgical, very calculated, planned out, but also very minute in the collateral damage that a drone strike exhumes. Is this a sign of maybe this is a new type of warfare we may be looking at? Is the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, Al?
Sure. Absolutely. And technology, we know all how the technology works, and this is will probably be looked back at as a very crude early effort in this regard.
Wow.
Yeah, it's drones are going to be one of the most important weapons that mankind has ever developed, in the sense that you can literally sit 10,000 miles away and you're the pilot of this drone, this little, and it can be literally, you know, as big as you want or as small as you want, and they can get to almost any place, and they can target literally and put a bomb through a window.
Ow.
But before we get too excited about this, it's just that the other side hasn't got them yet.
That's right.
And they will get them, and they will be able to put that through our window. And so it just escalates.
What's happening now is it's raising constitutional issues, violating another country's sovereignty. What about American citizens that are being targeted and then killed? I mean, how is that going to evolve?
You always
forward?
Have to deal with lawyers.
lawyers. We make
kidding.
The system work.
Yeah, no kidding.
We have full rights.
Thank you, lawyers. Yeah. Hey, we're going to talk about something a little bit more entertaining and regal. It is the Queen's 60th year in power. It is her Diamond Jubilee.
Woo!
And the Queen has done a good job of increasing her stature, increasing her popularity, increasing her visibility, if you will. Arguably, Al, the Queen has done great things in reviving her popularity in Great Britain. Why is that, do you think?
I am not sure. Probably by being quiet.
Really?
Yeah, I think the Queen or the King of England is by law got limited ability to.
But still, the head of state, though.
But they're still the head of state, and they still have a lot of respect. And I think, in fact, who here in our democracy, which we wouldn't trade for anything, doesn't kind of admire the whole tradition of the British monarchy? I mean, there's Henry VIII, and you go back beyond that, and the history is just a drama. And she's kind of a quiet period in the drama.
Well, the Queen Elizabeth is, in fact, 4 years away from being the longest-serving monarch in the history of Great Britain, which is thousands and thousands of years. Is it a testament to her strength, Bob, that we see Queen Elizabeth having the stature as head of state in Great Britain?
It's a statue to her wisdom about when to pull back and when to do a little, be a little bit more out.
Yeah, I was going to say it's testament to her restraint. You know,
she's been
very restrained.
She's a very smart lady in the way she has done her business.
She's been able to give a political and foreign policy advice to Cameron, but she does it in such a way as staying out of the limelight and in the background.
Well, she's given political and foreign advice to just about every resident of 10 Downing Street.
She's traveled the globe and met every head of state since 1953.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when the Queen of England, I mean, we can remember, although, Al, you bumped your head, you might not remember, so I'll refresh your memory. we remember.
Why?
Exactly. Definitely, Bob loves that one.
I'm staggered.
Bob loves that one. But, you know, we remember when the Queen came to the United States a few years ago. I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago, where she actually went to Richmond. She went down to Jamestown, a huge event here in Washington, D.C., and went all over. Even the Americans have a certain affability or admiration to the Queen. that we kind of almost wish she was kind of our royalty,
well,
almost.
Her stiff upper lip. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
And remind yourself of this. A decade, I think it's about a decade ago. When was it that Diana died?
Oh, it was longer than that.
1997.
Yeah,
97?
Right. Almost 15 years
that
ago.
That was about as bad a time as you could get.
Right. For
the royal family and all the rest of it. And she did a marvelous job.
Well, she was largely criticized for the handling of the Diana issue.
Yes, she was.
Largely was looked at as being a negative influence.
But she kept her cool about it, and she did everything that had to be done in a way that it worked out as probably about as well as it could be, because it was obviously, here's Diana, she's got a boyfriend, you know, they're getting killed and all this kind of stuff. I mean, there was all kind of bad PR, and she put a stiff upper lip, the British mode, and she sallied through it, and she did a hell of a job of pulling things back together and getting the monarchy back to be popular again, even without lovely Diana, who had been killed.
Al, I go to you. Is her popularity based on is her popularity based on more so the youth in her life right now? Ideally, you know, we got Prince William, Prince Harry, the wedding. Does that help her, or does the fact that she is what we would call a statue of the greatest generation?
Both. I think the young skip her son and moved to her grandchildren, and I think they have been very, very much a part of restoring respect for the...
last 3 years have been great.
Yes.
For Carl.
But without her being the stalwart that she was, that wouldn't have been able to do it.
Carl Toobin, you had a comment. Carl? No, we lost Carl.
Call back,
Carl.
Okay.
Go ahead, Ralph Winnie.
I think one thing that was very crucial after Diana was died in the car wreck, there was a lot of speculation and rumor that the royal family had Diana killed because she was pregnant with Dodi Fayed's child. That would have meant an heir to the British throne that was Muslim. So there's all this speculation and rumor.
But
Lyndon Johnson had JFK.
Right.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is they had a very open, transparent, and accountable tribunal that came out with the fact that Diana died in a car wreck, that there was no interference whatsoever from the royal family or from the British government.
Yeah.
And the royal family came out of that looking very good. They did not interfere in the tribunal at all. And from there, their stock continued to rise to where it is today.
Well, I mean, when we look at the royal family, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, we've all seen the pictures over the past weekend. I mean, it was typical London springtime,
right.
And yet
it rained like hell.
It rained like hell. It was cold as bollocks, and yet millions lined the banks of the Thames for the Royal Flotilla. Millions braved London in springtime for a gala concert, and it wasn't for the concert. It was basically a show of unity in support of the Queen. When we look back at the Queen, I mean, and she's not giving any indication that she's going anywhere anytime soon. But when we look back at the legacy of Queen Elizabeth, do we look at the young queen or the young princess who was driving ambulances during the Blitz on London? Do we look at the international queen of going to Canada, the Bahamas, African Commonwealth nations? Al, what's your thoughts?
We should look at all of that.
Yeah,
but I think that what we're looking at now is what will be remembered, because at our age we'll get older, and we it's her now, that dignity, that queen. I mean, she's a queen.
Yeah. Oh, there's no question.
Yeah,
she's a sovereign.
Yeah.
There's no question. She's a sovereign.
And she's carrying that off in her elder years, beautifully.
Are there politicians even in America that can take some advice on how to handle things politically from Queen Elizabeth, Bob?
How many shall we name?
She's the epitome of the goodwill ambassador. She's smart, she's savvy, and she really relates well to the average person who looks up to her and wants to emulate her style and grace.
And she's got something else that is amazing. I mean, she literally, I think, right, you know, in almost any crisis that would come up, there is no doubt in my mind that the government, maybe both parties, would go and talk to her and see what she thought. I mean, she really is someone who so bestrides the throne and is so popular over there that I cannot imagine the government taking a policy position that she fundamentally disagreed with. I don't say that lightly.
Carl Toobin, you have a comment? Nope, lost Carl again. When we look down the road, also Prince Philip, who's been by her side for many, many decades, and unfortunately, Prince Philip was not in attendance at some of the Jubilee events. He is currently hospitalized.
Yes.
At 91. He's got a bladder infection that he is contending with. Is it a situation where maybe? Should she, in fact, advocate the throne, maybe to Prince Charles or skip a generation, and advocate it to maybe Prince William? Bob, you're shaking your head no.
No. I don't think any monarch leaves until they die. If they do that, they damage the relationship of the family. And there's no way that she will suggest or anything will happen that will keep Charles from being the king.
There's nothing.
Sorry,
Justin.
I was hoping.
The reality is, the one thing about a monarchy is you have got to play by the strict rules of primogeniture and who's alive and who dies. And it's the death of the monarch triggers the change. Nothing else does. Unless you're beheading people because you don't like them, and that is basically stopped.
That basically stopped several centuries ago.
Yeah.
But they've.
Hello. Carl Toobin, you have a comment.
Right. Yeah, I have a few comments. Number one, I think they've changed that law in England, and if the young couple has a girl, she would be in line to be king after him. That's number one. Number two, I also think that part of the resurrection of the crown was the marriage that took place a year or two ago. And I think
You mean the recent one a couple of months ago, Prince William and Kate?
Was it a couple of months ago?
Yeah, wasn't that long?
Time flies when you're having fun. I think it was coming back, but I think that also struck a chord with the British people. And as has been said, their stock was very, very low when Prince Diana was killed in the auto accident, and it's an astounding comeback, but it's a comeback, and she deserves it. If she lives 3-4 years, she'll have beaten Queen Victoria. As far as the longest-running sovereign.
She's a lot better looking.
And she's a lot better looking than Queen Victoria ever was. True. But when we...
I wasn't there. Al, you must have been there. I wasn't...
Here's the other thing, though. When we look at, when we look at the gene pool Queen Elizabeth is coming from, I mean, the Queen Mom lived to 100.
Yeah.
So at 89,
she's up the kid. Yeah.
She's still young.
She's a teenager.
She is. Yeah. She is.
She's going to live at least another 10 years.
But are we ever going to see another sovereign like Queen Elizabeth in our history? Do you think, Al?
Well, I'm certainly not.
Nor will I.
Okay.
Good luck, Justin.
Yeah, hopefully. I hope we do. We need more people like her in this world.
Yeah, okay, that's what I was hoping we were going for, but apparently our two mummified political pundits decided to take another shot. It's amazing. are we? Is the world a better place with Queen Elizabeth, Bob?
Absolutely.
Why?
Because she is the supreme monarch for a number of countries.
She's still the head of state of many.
Canada.
Yep.
Australia. New Zealand. Just to name a few that are major countries.
Right.
I mean, and there are several others that I can't remember, but, you know, they're there.
I remember there was a routine that a bunch of British comedians did some years ago interviewing Prince Philip, who had been down at the handover of Rhodesia to Jomo Kenyatta.
Right.
And he says it was really very nice. They handled me very brilliantly. He shook me warmly by the throat. But he did promise to keep my wife's picture on the stamps.
by the way, Al, just to date yourself, that wasn't a few years ago. That was Dudley Moore.
It was about 1960, I think.
Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly right.
You know it's 2012 right now, Al.
But I'm trying to
remember the name of the group. They were wonderful.
Yeah.
Beyond the Fringe.
But, you know, the reality is that she is the sovereign for a number of nations around the world, and she is beloved by all of them.
Who all still adore her.
Yeah. She's been to, I think, every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's an amazing person, and she has done more to raise up to a higher level of appreciation and love probably anyone, maybe since before her great, maybe at least her great-great-grandfather.
Possibly.
Her favorability is
amazing.
It's over 85%.
Should we invite in, for just fairness doctrine reasons, some Englishman who really thinks the monarchy has done its day? You know, I mean, we love them. We're not Englishmen,
No, but I got to tell you something. You know, being over in London back in November, you definitely feel a sense of undying loyalty to the crown, and not the crown, but it's to her, not so much the sovereign power of the House of Windsor. They will literally throw themselves in Thames River in wintertime to help protect Queen Elizabeth II. Is she, I guess the question now becomes, has she become more of a people's queen than the typical sovereign that you would expect, Al?
I think that she has modernized to the point that where that is true.
She has a Facebook page.
She's what?
She has a Facebook page.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I don't even have one.
I think she learned from her father, who took over in very trying circumstances and had a speech impediment and really became beloved by the English people.
Yeah.
The movie was incredible.
Right.
Yeah, it was.
He was never meant to be king. He never expected to, but he rose to the challenge and was beloved by the British people.
Yeah.
And
well,
just think about this. She has been a queen for 60 years. 90-some% of her citizens in Great Britain and Scotland have never known anybody but her.
Right.
Right.
She is the crown.
Right.
Right. Very, very good.
That is a very, very powerful.
Very, very good.
Tough shoes to fill when she leaves.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to take another break, and we'll go into my favorite segment, Tell Me a Story. This is Backroom Politics live from Shilling's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Al's cringing. Surprise to everybody listening, Al probably doesn't have a story. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, for those who listen to Backroom Politics and know about Shelley's Backroom, they think of it as some sort of cigar bar where politicians go to smoke their cigars and drink their martinis. Actually, what you don't know about Shelley's Backroom has one of the greatest menus in the city. I kid you not. You've got the campfire wings, famous campfire wings. 1 pound of roasted, not fried, seasoned marinated jumbo chicken rings served with their own special honey mustard sauce. Folks, if you like chicken wings, you've never had the campfire wings. best wings in the city, bar none, I guarantee. If you don't like it, Al, you can call us up and tell us that you don't like it. You have daily specials. Come down on a day when they have the Justin Chicken Sandwich, the sandwich named after me, breaded chicken breast, provolone cheese, thick-cut bacon on a Kaiser roll served with a honey mustard sauce. Folks, it doesn't get more artery-clogging than that, but it is worth it. Come down to Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the premier sponsor of Backroom Politics. Testament to me losing control of the show. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom.
Am I still connected? 1331
F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We're going to start with Tell Me a Story, my favorite segment where we talk about news, innuendo, rumors, or anything like that that we talk about or hear around the Beltway. We'll start with you, Carl Toobin. Carl, tell me a story.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I have no story.
Okay. On behalf of Carl Toobin, thanks for joining us, Carl. I'm hanging up. Okay, there we go. When we gonna go to Bob Hines. Bob, please tell me a story.
Would you like me to tell you the one I mentioned
no,
earlier?
No, I'm banking on the fact that you have something good.
I can give you a serious one, and I am making a prediction with respect to the Republican ticket. And I believe that when all is said and done, that Mr. Romney is going to pick Senator Portman of Ohio.
Really?
For vice president.
Interesting.
And I
pick.
Will tell you why he's going to do it. Senator Portman has served, in addition to being a senator, he served six terms in the House.
Correct.
12 years. He knows everybody in the Senate, he knows everybody in the House, and everyone thinks highly of him. He will be a marvelous liaison from the White House, which does not know the Congress, to the Congress. Number two, the reason you'll pick him. He not only understands trade policy because he was the trade administrator of the Bush administration,
right.
And he also was the head of OMB, and he knows more about the budget and the money system than anybody else in the Congress or anybody in the Congress who's never done it.
Wow.
He is the perfect person. He is unfortunately not, he doesn't have a lot, any much more excitement to him, possibly, than the presidential nominee. But if you want competence, if you want knowledge, and if you want someone who everybody in this town respects, every Democrat respects the quality of his mind and his talent, this is the guy.
Wow. That's a great story. Ralph, tell me a story.
Following along those lines, when Mitt Romney picked Senator Portman as his vice presidential running mate,
Obama will paint Portman as someone who turns surpluses into deficits when Portman worked at OMB and USTR.
Wow. Al, I'm going to give you one shot at this. Yeah, I'm going to have a story.
I have a story.
You do?
I have a story. Next week. Next week.
Next week.
I will have a story.
Now, Justin, can I now step in?
Yes, you may, Bob, with your other story. Cover for Al, please. Yeah,
well, I was thinking about saying the following, but I was introduced not to do it. My other thought was the Queen is going to abdicate in favor of Charles tomorrow.
That's your other story?
Yes.
That's your other story?
Yes.
That's your other story, really.
Yes.
That's your other story.
Okay. Cool.
I can't resist.
That's your other story. I literally call on you thinking that you're going to come out with another piece of intel, and you come out with that crap.
I'm looking better to you now.
I'm sorry I hung up on Carl Tubin. Jesus. I don't believe this.
Well, we'll hold you to it.
Yeah. I don't believe this. Amazing. You know, when you listen to Backroom Politics, I hope that you get something out of this. I hope that you get, you know, hey, I can actually learn something about the political insights of what happens in Washington. And then we have people like Al and Bob who come up with great nuggets of intel like that. Trust me. Remember, Backroom Politics broke the story about Secretary Panetta and General Petraeus taking over CIA. And then Bob comes up with that.
Hey,
here we go. This is going to be another great nugget. Go ahead, Al. Go ahead.
The whole genesis of this program and the previous group that we founded was that people who disagree pretty fundamentally on some political things can be friends and can discuss issues.
That's true.
Civilly.
Very true.
And can tease each other and all of that and continue to be friends. And I think this program, among others, demonstrates the principle of this program, that you can be civil and discuss politics. We do that every week.
Yeah, but we also drink halfway through the show, so that also means, A, we're probably buzzed by 6 o'clock. And cigars help, too. Hey, we got 2 minutes left. On behalf of Congressman Al Swift.
Well, you just blew the one serious thing I've said in the whole program.
No. Let me be clear, Al. Let me be clear. You blew that minutes ago. On behalf of Congressman Al, on behalf of Bob Hines, Ralph Winnie, Carl Tubin, who I hung up on minutes ago, this is Radio's Justin Russell. I'm your moderator of this mess. We'll be back next Tuesday in a split edition of Backroom Politics. We will see you next week. Have a great week, Washington.